This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight. We'll have Edgar Gitua, an international relations security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University, Nairobi, on the proposed Kenya-Haiti security deployment. We also will look at U.S. President Joe Biden's State of the Union address. And we will hear from women on the continent on International Women's Day. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden used his third State of the Union speech Thursday to announce the U.S. military will lead a new mission to build a temporary pier in Gaza to allow aid into the territory. He also called for Israel to protect civilians in its war with Hamas.
To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
In other parts of his speech, Biden worked to persuade voters he deserves a second term in office by highlighting economic gains and blaming the opposition Republican Party for blocking legislation to address the migration crisis. He also criticized former President Donald Trump. Alabama Senator Katie Britt delivered the Republican response.
President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch. Under his administration, families are worse off. Our communities are less safe.
Former President Trump is expected to face Biden in the November presidential election. He called Biden's speech angry and polarizing, and he criticized Biden's mental capacity because of his age. Biden is 81 years old and Trump is 77. For more on the annual State of the Union speech, VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wudakaswara is on the line with me now. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Patsy.
My pleasure to be with you.
So let's look at the speech. There are concerns about Biden's age as he campaigns. How did he address that issue?
Well, I think this was really forceful, how he handled that. And the speech really sets the tone for his re-election campaign and somewhat eased Democrats' concerns about his age. And also the other big issue for Democrats, which is his unconditional support for Israel's war in Gaza, which you have mentioned earlier with what the president announced, which is an extraordinary measure. But in terms of his age, the president addressed it directly, saying that, you know, I may be old, but my ideas are not old. And then he used that line to attack Donald Trump, saying that hate, anger, revenge, those are the oldest ideas in the history of mankind, but they are not good ideas for America, essentially. And so you can see that throughout this speech, over an hour, he did not mention Trump's name even once, but he did mention his predecessor more than a dozen times, again and again and again, reminding Americans, without mentioning Trump's name, that the former president represents a threat to democracy on numerous issues, on support on Ukraine, on abortion rights, and the other issues that are of concern to American voters.
Now, let's talk about his comments on the war in the Middle East. What was his message?
So this was quite a surprise in terms of, you know, this rare rebuke that he delivered to Israel about how humanitarian aid should not be used as a bargaining chip. So we expected Biden to say all the right notes on Israel, about his support for Israel's right to self-defense against Hamas, his calls for a ceasefire, protection of Palestinian civilians. But by announcing that really dramatic measure and very expensive measure, I mean, imagine this. He already said no boots on the ground, so that means no American soldiers are going to do this. But they're planning to build a pier off the coast of Gaza and then somehow pushing it to shore to ensure that aid can come in through Cyprus, through this maritime corridor. It's still unclear how the aid is going to go from that pier, that temporary pier, to the people of Gaza, because there's a whole sort of logistic and security issues that are still not yet addressed. But by announcing this dramatic measure, he's really trying to target his democratic base, you know, the progressives, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, who are all angry at him for his unconditional support of Israel. You can see this in the primaries, quite a significant number of Democrats marking uncommitted on their ballots as a signal to President Biden that they may not vote for him in November if he continues down this route.
And immigration and border security, how did Biden address that issue?
So this is a weak spot for President Biden because immigration has become a key issue for voters, not just on the Republican side, but also Democrats. But the way he addressed it is by telling Congress and the American people that, look, we have this bill. We have this bill that has already been approved by the Senate, and it's now in your hands. And the reason why you're not voting for it, House Republicans, is because Donald Trump told you not to, because he wants this as an election issue. He doesn't want to give this as an election win to Biden. So stop playing politics. That's essentially his message. That's how he addressed it. I mean, clearly, immigration is a big issue. It's a potential Achilles heel for him. And so he addressed it by turning it on the offense towards Trump.
VOA's White House Bureau Chief, Patsy Wida-Kaswara, thank you for your input.
My pleasure. Thank you.
An agreement between Kenya and Haiti to send police from the East African nation to help fight gangs in Haiti has raised hopes the Nairobi-led UN-backed multinational peace mission could deploy soon. However, Edgar Gitua, an international relations security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, says that might not happen. In talking to me, he says that a court decision put the brakes on the deployment, and once the Kenyan government overcomes the legal hurdles, he says it can move ahead with the planned deployment.
I think for the Kenyan government, the biggest challenge was the legality of why it was sending its soldiers without any formal agreement, any formal invitation. Now, with the Prime Minister's reciprocal visit to the country and reciprocal agreement, I think for the Kenyan government, it clears the legal hurdle, and in a court of law going forward, when they argue their case, when they appeal and argue the case, they will say we have a formal request from the Haitian government to go and intervene.
But the question is, Professor, does the deal have public support? Because Kenyans have questioned the wisdom of sending police officers to fight in a heavily armed gangsters where the country faces security challenges of its own.
You're very right. The Kenyan public is very divided on the issue. And I think the division is arising from the fact that a lot of information has not been given to the public. For example, in Kenya, we have very specialized battalions, very specialized forces within the police force. But we are not being told who exactly is going to be sent. The lack of public support is largely due to the vacuum, the information vacuum that exists in the country. How that can be solved is if the government cleanly, clearly comes out and tells the people, these are the soldiers we have chosen, these are the policemen we have chosen, and they are capable, they are well equipped, to just give the public assurances. So right now we are operating in communication and information vacuum, and that's why there are so many rumors where so many people are dissatisfied. The other reason why Kenyans are not supporting this is largely because Kenyans feel that the country has many problems of its own and is asking, why are we sending out police officers when they can be dealing with our own sense of insecurity? We have banditry, we have a lot of cattle rustling. So the Kenyans are divided because they feel the government is not doing enough to rectify the security situation within the country before it sends the soldiers out of the country.
And another point, Professor, is rights watchdogs have also pointed out that Kenyan police have a history of using sometimes lethal force against civilians, and that they pose an unacceptable risk in Haiti, where foreign troops have committed abuses in past interventions.
Yes, I agree with you. Thanks for that. And this debate, at least I've had this debate with other people forward, and the consensus is, yes, the Kenyan police force has its own human rights abuses, issues, and those ones have been singled out to a few officers, and we've been told action has been taken. But largely looking at the Haiti mission, the Kenyan force needs to change its mindset. It should not go to Haiti thinking they are going to quell and suppress those gangs. Those gangs are better prepared. Those gangs are more violent than anything they have ever dealt with. And preferably from what we've read, those gangs are probably even more advanced in terms of equipment, the equipment and better armed. That is their country. There is also a language barrier. So the Kenyan police going to Haiti at this particular time need to go and work more with the community to go and find out how can they support the community.
Why in the first place did Ruto agree to this kind of a peace deal for Haiti?
By taking up this mission, Kenya propels its image higher in the international system. And no wonder the U.S. quickly responded and said it is going to give out some money, between $100 and $200 million to support this mission. So Kenya was just trying, number one, to improve its image in international relations. Kenya was trying to answer the call of a country in distress. These are Haitians. Remember, these are our cousins, our African cousins who went there many years ago. So Kenya was just trying to answer that distress call by another nation state. Why other countries refused to do it? Some have their own problems. The Americans probably have been there before, and the Haitians tell them they are not welcome anymore. The Brazilians went there, committed a lot of atrocities. Other peacekeeping missions have not worked before. So this was a chance at Kenya proving to the world that it can do something differently and be successful at it.
That was Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He talked to me from Nairobi. Tunisia is known as the birthplace of the Arab Spring uprisings. It also is recognized for its progress on gender policies, particularly compared with some of its neighbors in the Middle East and Africa. For VOA, Noura Hafiadi in Tunisia has more.
Tunisian women, like those in the rest of the world, celebrate International Women's Day on Friday. For many people, it's a day for acknowledging what they have achieved for women's rights so far. For some, it is an occasion to recognize and continue the fight against challenges that still exist today, creating gender inequality. In 1956, immediately after independence from France, President Habib Bourguiba granted women citizenship rights. The personal status code or family law also eliminated polygamy, introduced a legal age for women to marry, granted women guardianship of their children in the event of the father's death, and made it possible for women to initiate divorce for the first time. The state also created the National Union of Tunisian Women to implement the reforms. In recent days, International Women's Day has played prominently on social media sites in Tunisia. For instance, Facebook users circulated video clips. Noor Boukadida is one of a few women in the country who cut men's hair. Speaking to Voice of America, Noor says she chose man's shaving because since she was a little girl, she had been watching videos about this type of shaving, and little by little she fell in love with it and decided to learn it. She says her family was open to this choice, and they helped her to open her own salon. She says she was subjected to a lot of criticism on social media, but that was a great motivation to continue this profession. The 1990s ushered in a second wave of legal reforms. President Zain al-Abidin Ben Ali created the Women's and Family Affairs Ministry, a post for an advisor to the President on Women's Affairs, and the Center for Studies, Documentation and Information on Women. In 1993, The state reformed the nationality code to allow Tunisian mothers to pass their citizenship to their children born to non-Tunisian fathers. The role of women in Tunisian society was seen in a confrontation led by women after the Arab Spring uprising protest in 2011. Women had a decisive role in overthrowing the Ennahda movement. Raja Shebbi is the granddaughter of the Tunisian Arab poet Abul Qasim Shebbi, who rose to the upper ranks of the Tunisian Ministry of Interior.
Academic background did not directly contribute to my professional career. In 1991, I succeeded in a competition with the Ministry of the Interior to join the law enforcement forces, eventually becoming the first woman to be promoted to the rank of General Commissioner First Category in Tunisia and the Arab world. This wasn't something I had planned, but I worked hard, doing the best I could.
I met Zuhairi works with the aid organization Oxfam in Tunisia, and has focused closely on women's issues.
The feminist movement in Tunisia is continuing the fight. For decades, we are looking for equality. We are looking for changing the path of policies, laws, and social norms towards achieving equality in rights and equality in front of the law. That's a long way, but the fight will continue, and it will be one day our dream.
He and other activists, however, say they are concerned that rights of Tunisian women have been eroded somewhat, including when the constitution was revised in 2022, removing some of the language on women's equality. Also, women faced harassment at the polls in the country's 2022 election. Noura Hafayez, Voice of America, Tunis.
For more on International Women's Day, check out voaafrica.com. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Thousands of Cameroonian women were out on the streets today, International Women's Day, to press for more access to education and economic opportunity and an end to harmful prejudices and practices. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
All across the nations, all around the world.
Thousands of women listen to what is now referred to as the women's anthem, blasting through speakers on Yaoundé's May 20 Boulevard. The Central African States Ministry of Women's Empowerment said about 30,000 women came out to mark this year's International Women's Day, most wearing special green and yellow gowns bearing the slogan, "Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress." The women sang about longing to be free and achieving true equality with men. Rights activist Moma B. Yvonne said women want to end the perception that they should be limited to raising children, domestic chores, and farm work.
Women just want a level playing ground. Women want equal opportunities. Women want that the gender gap that has been delaying for so long be bridged. If you have a female and a male child, give them the same opportunities. Level the playing ground.
Moma said illiteracy among women remains high because many families still prefer to only send boys to school. Protesters said that preference blocks women from positions in public offices where literacy is a requirement. They also complained that men own more than 85% of Cameroon's land and will only sell it to other men or only hand it over to their sons. Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment, says President Paul Biya is committed to improving the conditions of women. She says the appointment of more women as managers of state corporations and directors of administrative offices shows there is a political will to end prejudices and involve women in decision-making.
Many of them do not know their rights. If they want to progress, they must have the will. And I think the government is doing a lot to allow women to really emerge. Women have proven that they can be in all domains, but we still need to do more to see that all those who enter primary education, they are not dropped out.
Ondwa noted that Cameroon currently has over 60 women in the country's 180-member National Assembly, the lower house of parliament, and about 50 women who are mayors in towns and cities. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
At least 19 African nations are expected to vote in elections this year at a time when some political analysts say many leaders and political parties are undermining democracy. They say politicians and military juntas continue to undercut democratic rights across Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
Algeria, Chad, Ghana, Senegal, South Africa and Togo are just a few of the nations expected to elect new leaders in the coming months. Frederick Kempe, president of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., characterizes it as a time of hope and peril.
This also comes at a time when innovative technologies like artificial intelligence can be forces for progress and forces for democracy, but they can even be used as effective tools for surveillance and control by autocrats. Over the past 4 years, Africa has seen coups and military transitions across Gabon, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad, Guinea, Mali, and Sudan. These events have resulted variously from flawed elections, attempts to change constitutional term limits, the inability of civilian governments to effectively address security and development challenges.
Kempe was speaking during a recent webinar hosted by the Council, a foreign policy research institute. Well-known African democracy activist Mo Ibrahim told the audience he's not optimistic.
The question in front of us is the state of democracy in Africa, and I can answer that in a very short sentence. It is bad and deteriorating. We have seen continuous deterioration of freedoms and rights of citizens, and this has been deteriorating for the last 5 years or so, unfortunately.
Ibrahim says it'll sound fantastic to say 20 African countries voted in 2024, but the reality is darker.
Only 7 have term limits. The rest either never had term limits or modified or changed term limits to enable incumbents to continue in office. Some 500 million people of Africa, that's one third of our population, don't have proof of identity. So they cannot register, they cannot vote.
Ibrahim says almost all African elections are plagued by logistical problems such as insufficient ballots and polling stations.
An example of what happened in latest election in DRC, 27 of the polling stations did not even open. Of those who opened, 45% of the voting machines malfunctioned.
Research from Ibrahim's foundation shows a big part of what should be Africa's major voting bloc, young adults, won't vote in the coming elections.
They don't vote in large numbers because they lost faith in the process. They don't lose faith in the democracy. Democracy is popular. If you ask people in Africa which system of governance you like, they will say democracy. But they don't recognize their own system as a democratic system because of abuse of power and misrule. Many of them, unfortunately, decide just to ignore elections and the process, and we lose that.
Tessa Dooms is a South African political activist. As director of the Rivonia Circle, a Johannesburg-based pro-democracy group, she crosses the continent asking young people about elections.
Many young people that we speak to at the Rivonia Circle are talking about feeling like their vote doesn't matter, feeling like that voting doesn't change things, having watched their parents and their grandparents vote over the years, and have not seen the dividends of democracy and are questioning whether or not their vote will matter. Others are struggling to find who to vote for and are looking at...
Dooms says young Africans are completely disconnected from the elderly politicians who run most countries on the continent, while most abhor the big men with guns who rule by fear. They, like many older people, Doom says, won't vote because they feel the candidates that are running don't care about their interests. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice.